We have an illustrated talk this evening. As we know, Brother and Sister Shrimpton have been to Israel, I think, once or twice. Very familiar with the settings of the city. And he's going to share with us the consideration of Jerusalem at the time of Jesus. Brother Mark.
I have three reasons for giving this particular talk, and it's put into the program as a series of two talks. I'm speaking this evening, of course, because somebody else couldn't do it and asked me to move ahead. But with three reasons for giving this sequence, and the first one is that about 5 years ago, the meeting brought a series of slides about Jerusalem. There's 178 slides. They've been sitting in the showcase for about the last 5 years, and nobody's looked at them. So I think it's time that we got them out and the rest of you had a little bit of a notion of the treasure trove that the meeting actually owns here. I have these slides at the moment and, you know, we'll get them back to the meeting when I'm finished with them for the rest of you to use. The first set of slides is, so the second reason is that there is an enormous amount of information about Jerusalem, and we can illustrate it, some with personal slides and some with this series of the meeting slides. And then given what we know of Jerusalem, there's quite a bit of the New Testament that comes alive for you because you can see it and you realize what was spoken and what was going on and how the interactions happened between the individuals that Jesus was talking to. There are four booklets, here's one of them. Which go with the slides, five booklets that go with the slides, four series of slides, and this one. So, and a couple of pamphlets in here. There's really a lot of very good archaeological information which the meeting has at its disposal. And a model of the temple, which again the meeting purchased a number of years ago, and which is in the showcase quite often, but people don't always look at it. So if we can catch the rest of the lights now that I've done my little introduction, and we'll see what we can see. Yeah, please. The first set of slides that the meeting owns deals with the development of the ark and how the ark moved from Sinai, and this is Jebel Musa, as it's called, the Mount of Moses, which is one of the sites that people feel Moses went up to the mountain to receive the law and receive the plans for the ark, the tabernacle, and the other items which belonged in Jewish worship. And then this series of slides, we've just got four of them here. This is Kadesh Barnea, where the Israelites camped for a number of years, and it's presumed that this was the actual site where that camp of Kadesh Barnea at that time. And then the ark would have been there for the number of years when the Israelites were waiting to cross into their promised land, and the spies were sent out from Kadesh Barnea. Now, you remember that the ark spent a certain amount of time in the hands of the Philistines due to the attitude of the Israelites at the time. And there was a time in the movement of the ark when it was put upon a cart which was drawn by two milk cows, and the two milk cows took the route from Beth Shemesh. And you're looking at the site of Beth Shemesh and the flat area in behind. And in the background, you see a little notch, a little sort of pass there. And that is the route that the cart would have taken when it moved from the hands of the Philistines and came to the border of the boundary, as it were, between the Philistines and the Hebrews. And then when it came back into the possession of the Hebrew people, there was no temple built at this time, and the ark was left in the house of Obed-Edom. And there is a artist's rendering of what that house would have looked like when the ark resided in it. Now, this is interesting because Obed-Edom was a Gittite, which meant that he was a Philistine background, and hence the ark was looked after by a Gentile, presumably one that had become a proselyte at the time, until it was moved and placed on the mountain where the temple now sits. Now, this is one of my personal slides, and it's the view from the Temple Mount as we see it today. Now, if you look at where that large golden dome is in the background, you'll see a small black dome just in front of it. If you draw a line from the middle of that big golden dome through that little black dome, you come to a point which is just about the height of land in the Mount of Olives. That would have been the orientation of the temple at the time when Solomon first built it. Headed with the entrance to the temple, headed right to the top of the Mount of Olives. Now, the other thing to grasp when you're looking at this slide, there are two other things to grasp. And the first one was that Herod, when he built the temple, sheathed it with gold. So the shine from the temple would have been at least what you're seeing there from that golden dome. It was a remarkable sight. Now, the second thing to notice based on this slide is the height. Look at the dome and look at the way that dome projects up above the flat area, which is pretty close to the height of the Temple Mount at the time when, of Hezekiah certainly, and later on in the time of Herod. The temple which Solomon built and which was later built to about the same height by Herod was a half again as tall as that dome. So 1.5 times higher than that dome was the height of the temple that the Israelites, that the disciples took Jesus up onto the Mount of Olives to look down on. It must have been a really remarkable sight. Now that is a sequence of little sketch maps of Jerusalem at different stages in its development. Now that little sort of rectangular area, top left-hand corner, is the Temple Mount. You see there's a red and a sort of blue-black line which extend down from that and come around and go back. That was the extent of David's city and Solomon's city. And you see the one line is a little more extensive than the other. Solomon extended the city slightly to the north. The other two lines which extend out and around and finally encompass the yellow area are the development of the city under Herod. When Herod took over the city, it had approximately the size of that inner black line. When Herod's city was finished, and you remember the words in John that the temple was 40 and 7 years in the building. So Herod's plan was started in 19 BC, and he continued work on, and his plan kept being worked on until after the time when Jesus had been crucified. The temple, the city then in its full extent was much larger than it had ever been. Now that's one thing to keep in mind at this point. So when you look from the Mount of Olives today, you're looking at the two domes, the little silver dome off to the left, and the golden dome in the center, which is the point where the temple would have been. And in the background, you see the modern city of Jerusalem extending on behind there. And that area was the area where Herod extended his city mostly, because it was more pleasant up there. The winds were sort of caught that in the summertime. It was a little cooler in the evenings. Also, it was away from the sort of slums, I guess they would have been by now, which was the area still inhabited, which had been the site of the original city of David and the original Jebusite city. So what we're going to do today in this series is focus on the temple. There's a very good model of the temple, which was made about 40 years ago, but it's actually still quite accurate. The slides that I'll show you are based on that 40-year-old model, with a couple of additional slides from the newer sequence, which illustrate where there have been slight changes in the approach to the temple. And what I want you to keep in mind as we go through it is that this was the city that Jesus saw. That was a reasonably good representation of the color and the magnificence of the building that Jesus went into. That's the one thing which stands out. The pride that the priests had in that building, and this shows in many cases, the confrontation between Jesus and them because they were very, very involved in the magnificence of the structure that they looked at. You're looking there at the Golden Dome, at the present site of where the city, where the temple would have been at the time of Jesus. So, again, that's sort of rectangular area is the Temple Mount. Up in the top, that red line coming down on the one side, on the south side of the temple, is we'll look at it in a minute. It was a marketplace. It was the store. Now, if you look at that map, you see that there are clear areas around it, and then there are quite dense areas where there are small houses. Those are places where the ordinary people lived. The open spaces around the temple were really quite important, and they figure many times in what goes on between Jesus, his disciples, and the people that worshipped in the temple. You also notice these broad yellow stripes, which were roads. And those broader roads all had their origins either in the time of the Maccabees or were built by Herod. And that was different, very different from the cities of most of the cities throughout the Middle East. Because these cities, and if you go into Old Jerusalem today, it's still like a rabbit warren. Narrow streets, and it's so easy to get lost in them, and you sort of wonder how people can find their way in and out. But the density of population in those areas is fantastic. It's amazing. It's almost unbelievable. And one Roman traveler from the time of Christ estimated that in Jerusalem there was probably 600,000 people living. So think what you have to do then when the population doubles. And we see this happen in places like Salt Spring Island and so on nowadays in the summer, where overnight the population will double. Well, where do they all go? Where can they go? If they're going to walk around, they have to have open places to meet in, to talk in, to shop and to do all the other things that they do. And that was the thing which came down, but through Herod, to the time of Jesus. And there was more. We'll get to that in the next talk. Anyway, we're looking now from the north. Just off the corner of the slide to the left would have been the Antonia Fortress, which was where the Roman garrison was kept. So you're looking from the north side to the temple in the center there, which not quite in the center, and in the background is the Stoa, which was the marketplace sanctioned by the high priests. So it's a large, flat, or relatively flat temple area. And yet you can see it broken up in a few places because the mountain was not flat, of course. It sloped away. And so to accommodate that, there had to be several places where there were stairways built into the temple mount platform and also into the holy place itself. Now, we're going to start then at the Wailing Wall. Almost everyone has either heard of or seen or knows something about the Wailing Wall. It's the oldest surviving part of the of Herod's temple, and it's intact. That wall at the base is intact. Something else to keep in mind here, and that is that there's 70 feet of Herodian masonry below the present floor level. Herod went down to bedrock to put the foundations of the walls that he built to support the temple structures and to support the walls where he extended the Temple Mount. He went down 70 feet. So there's a lot of Herod's masonry which is still intact and still standing. Now, we need to just hold on to a little idea here. Because Jesus, when his disciples took him apart to look at the stones, look at the magnificence of the temple, turned around and said to them, "There shall not be one stone left upon another." And there have been plenty of people that have criticized the Bible record because of that. Because they say, well, obviously, Jesus can't be a prophecy. The temple, large parts of it, are still standing. So hopefully I'll remember to come back to this when we get around to the east wall, because there's more evidence of what point I want to make on that east wall. If I don't, maybe somebody can ask me about it when I step down at the end. Top left-hand corner, you see an archway. You can go in through there. There's an iron gate, and there's a security guard at the point in that gate. But you can go in at that point and walk along the Wailing Wall and walk right along for quite a number of yards inside there, and walk along the old original masonry which Herod laid and which was in evidence at the time when Jesus was walking on the earth. Now, just to the left of the present-day Wailing Wall, there was a gate. Steps leading up to this gate and a roadway which went along by the base of the temple along the west wall, along the current Wailing Wall, but some 20 feet lower than the current level of the Wailing, of the pavement at the Wailing Wall. And there were entrances into the temple, and inside that are a sequence of stairways up to get to the height of the actual temple platform. Now, these slides are all taken from that 40-year-old model of the temple. They're very good. There's a very good commentary. So if you... Oops, sorry, I'm going back. No, I'm not. Yep. There's a very good commentary. So you can figure out exactly what's happening and do the research for yourself, relate it to what you see. At the southwest corner of the temple, there's what's known as Robinson's Arch, because it was discovered by somebody called Robinson. And the steps up into the temple from the road level at the time of Jesus are illustrated for you there. You go up those stairs and then on into the temple. But notice also that there are vertical lines, and there's a structure up above there, and the horizontal lines we'll look at later, because this shows you the other activities which went on surrounding the temple. So there's a series of steps going up again into the stoa, which was the marketplace in the temple area, and a gradually rising set of stairs there to the left, you see, and that then went along the southern wall of the temple. Archways in the typical Roman masonry, and the whole thing was done very cleverly. Now here you're looking at the east, at the south wall, looking at the stairway going up. You've come up from the side, from the left-hand side. You're going up the stairs and into the temple platform where there's a marketplace. Down below, you see little figures beside that, and a series of archways going along off towards the right. And these were shops. And below you, you see a flat area coming out towards you. And that, of course, was a gathering place. Right at this corner, there were three different roads come together. So people arrived from all parts of the city at this particular point, the southwest corner of the temple platform. Also then, it was the way so many of these areas are in our city. It was a shopping district. There's all of those little stores along the side, and up to the left was another sequence of stores going up the west wall, which is now known as the Wailing Wall, and those stores extended right on down. Now, if you had gone up those stairs and into the temple platform itself, you would have arrived at a stoa which looked like this. The open colonnade opens out into the open air and the temple platform. There would have been stores all the way along this area on the left, and this was where much of the buying and selling took place that was sanctioned by the priests. So if you wanted to buy a suitable dove, say, for a sacrifice, it would be there. And we know from Josephus that the markup on those animals was rather horrendous. So if you were unable to bring your own a sacrifice, or if the priests did not accept that sacrifice, then you had to come here to purchase whatever it was you needed. And it would not have been unfavorable exchange rates. Now, at the far end of that stoa was where the Sanhedrin met. And there, in the colours, you can see the area that that the high priests that gathered to preside over the colony of priests, which was the magistrate's court in the time of Jesus. Looking now from the open air back into that store, you see there were three levels. There were apartments up above and the shopping area, which was in the colonnade, which we have just looked at. We're going to go now progressively along this southern wall. We've been looking at this step that goes up with a sort of dog's leg, which is in the foreground, and then into the store, which we just left, which is going along at the top of that marketplace. You can see the little rows of masonry and a few little windows here and there, which indicate the height of the different levels, at the different stories which were in there. And we're going now to go along this wall and look at that set of stairs, which is sort of halfway up the picture there on the left, the buildings which are there in the middle, and the stairs which were below, and then go around the corner to the eastern side. But before we actually go along that wall, up above where the marketplace was, in this southwestern corner, looking right down over the old city of Jerusalem and out towards some of the newer districts which were moving off in a western wall, there was what was called the place of trumpeting. And that was where the herald for the day sounded the hours so that people would know that now worship was starting within the temple. And again, when things came to a conclusion, a trumpet was blown from that platform, which was way up at the top. Now, how do we know it was there? Because the stone was found down below that corner where the Romans had obviously dislodged it and caused it to fall down. How do we know that it was the stone which was used? Because on the inside of that stone, there is this inscription that it was for the place of trumpeting. Now, that inscription would not have been seen when the temple was finished. And this, again, is an important point to keep in mind. Because Herod, when he went to the high priests, and when he wanted to start this building project, told them what he had in mind, and they objected violently. Because they would have to disrupt the operations of the temple to do it. Not only that, they did not want any heathen hands working on their temple. So Herod did what Solomon had done many years previously. Everything was prefabricated off-site. And then after it had been prefabricated and carts set aside specifically for the purpose and priests trained to move the materials and put them in place, and trained as stonemasons to actually do the work in the very holy areas of the temple, it was then that they started. The priests, their final criticism of Herod is the criticism which is going through a lot of our political process today. Can you afford it? And Herod, to satisfy them, said, yes, I can afford it. We'll have the whole thing pre-cut, ready. All you have to do then is move it on site and fit it together. And here you see the marks of that prefabrication. That inscription would not have been visible when it was finished. It's the same thing as buying a little child's toy block set. You know, block one goes here, block two goes there, and block something else goes somewhere else. It was marked, and they knew where it would go, and it had been cut to fit off-site and simply put in place. Now, there's a view of what the marketplace would have looked like along the southern wall. And if you look out in front of you, there's this large gathering area. Now, most of the people who went into the temple probably went in from this southern side. There's one place where Jesus went into the temple when he was coming down from the Mount of Olives, and when on the occasion when he overthrew the money changers, it said he went into the city and then into the temple. So on that occasion, Jesus probably went into this flat area and then up the steps, which you see in the background. And then we'll show you how you get into the temple in a little while from that route. But there was the shopping district. And if you look at that corner now, the shopping area would have been along the horizontal plane which you have there beneath you. The arches which you see in the middle of the wall, that's part of Robinson's Arch, which supported the set of stairs and the archways which went up to the level to get into the temple. And that's what it looked like actually about 20 years ago when we were there. So the steps which led up to those two gates. To the left, there's a building. And in that building was a ritual bath. And it was very important if you were actually going to do something within the temple that you cleansed yourself in preparation for that, for what it was that you were doing. You would have cleansed yourself in that bathhouse, which is there on the left. Come out of that, gone up the stairs, and in through the right-hand door, probably the right-hand door. This seems to be what most people consider to have been the way it was done. It was done for two reasons. One, that there would be an orderly flow of people, of course. But secondly, that if you had cleansed yourself for something in the temple, you would not be mixed up with people coming back in the other direction from the left-hand side. And also, if you stayed right on the right, anyone who was just going in for you know, just to see what was going on or to talk or to meet somebody could stay on the left-hand side of the right-hand side of this path and stay away from you, because ritual purity was terribly important. And we meet this idea many times within the gospel. And Jesus is very critical of the high priests for the way they stress this to the absence of many other values. Two gates to separate those going in from those coming out, the bath right close so that you could purify yourself before you went in. That's what the stairs look like today. Now, we went up those stairs and the last trip that we took to Palestine, and it was really very interesting because we sort of walked up them and then walked back down them, and we didn't quite register what was going on until the young woman, and I believe it was the Kathleen that wrote this book, she is some young archaeologist there, but I don't know for certain. She talked to us from down below and said, you know, how are you making out on the stairs sort of thing, and engaged us in a little discussion about this. Because, quite interestingly, it was very hard to walk straight up or straight down those stairs. Because the rise and the stairs is quite normal. It's very similar to the riser which we have on our staircases nowadays. But the tread was much larger. So what you found yourself doing when you came either up or down those stairs was walking up them at an angle. And going up them somewhat more slowly, it was not that easy to sort of run up or run down. Now, in many buildings in Greek and Roman period, that particular design of stairs was done so that you had to sort of slow up as you came down, and you were dispersed. You did move at an angle. It was partly done for crowd control. So when you consider that there were lots of people going in and out, it makes a lot of sense to disperse them into the flat area, which was a shopping district and a meeting, a plaza, down below. But there was another reason, possible reason, and there it's given to us in this booklet that Lean Rittenmeyer wrote. And he said that going up those stairs more slowly gives you more of a chance to sort of stop on a tread and think about where you're going. It's a little more worshipful, a little more reverent way of being drawn into the temple. So there's a quick look at the, firstly, at the mikvah, the ritual bath, which is the first building which you see next to the stairs. The building beyond that is dubbed a council house by most archaeologists. And in Josephus and in the Midrash, some of the Jewish writings, it mentions that there were three places where the law was purveyed in the temple area. And one of them quite clearly was near the south entrance. So it is felt that that second building was a place for legal considerations, whether you were discussing a legal matter or considering how you would approach a legal matter. The priests would be there to talk over the legality of your position. And that was the building where these things took place, one of them. There were two others which I don't think people have exactly determined where they were yet. And there again, you see the stairs and you see what I was telling you earlier about the way the risers and the treads are developed. And we're now going gradually along to the end of the southern wall. The three gates, which are there at the top of this narrower set of steps, which is now beyond the council house, as it's called. But notice also that the stores continue, and they continue all the way along this southern wall. And notice also that this flat area out in front of those stores is extended. It's a large open plaza, a place where people gathered. The double gate in the background is the one we talked about a moment ago. There's three gates here, one large one and two on each side, immediately in front of you. Now, these three gates end up right underneath the what's known as the Al-Aqsa Mosque today. They lead into a tunnel, as it were, a corridor, a passageway, and they come out at those two places which you see in front of you there in the middle of that flat temple courtyard. On the right is the store that we talked about earlier, the marketplace, so with its two chambers up above, and the Sanhedrin met in the far distance. On the left, the line going away from you, which is just in front of the exit from those two corridors where you came in from the double and the triple gate that we saw a moment ago, that is the middle wall of partition. That was a wooden platform which was there in the temple in the time of Herod. And we'll come back to this in a minute when we get to look at the detail of the east wall. But keep in mind that that whole area there was separated from the balance of the temple platform, which extends off to your left. So if you had washed yourself and you had come up through from that second gate, up the stairs that entered you there, you would be right in front of a sequence of gates which took you then, further into the temple platform and then into what was known as the Hulda gates into the temple itself. So middle wall of partition there is extending out beyond you. Okay, so this takes us right to the end of the of the east wall. South wall, to the eastern end of the south wall. And what I put this slide in for is that so you can see the structure of the masonry up above that horizontal line. This is typical of Roman masonry of the period, and so it has been inferred from bits of broken stone as well as from writings that that was the color and the design of the temple structure. It was a rather impressive looking building. If you had gone in through those three gates that we said were reserved for the priests, through that narrower staircase, you would have ended up in here. This is a cloistered area. There were stores, storehouses underneath there. And there was another entrance into this area, which we'll see in a minute. And then the passageway extended on and came up the stairs right close to where the middle wall of partition is. But this then was considered to be a store area for general supplies that would be needed by the priests. We're going to come around this corner, which you're looking straight at this point. The line which extends along, comes towards you from the right, is, of course, along the south wall. We've just been talking about that. That's where the stores are and so forth, and the two staircases going up. And we're coming around now to the east wall. And there's, again, a little staircase going up. And you see that stair which goes up, turns a right-hand corner, and that goes into the area that we just looked at, the area where the priestly stores were kept. Yeah. So the other thing that I want to point out at this point is the tower with that little bit of extra roof on it. This was described as the pinnacle of the temple. So when we read about Jesus being taken to the pinnacle of the temple, this was the area that was intended in the drawing. Now, beneath you, the ground falls away very quickly because you're going into the Kidron Valley. And as we'll see shortly when we look at some of the other slides from this, along this east wall, the area was very steep going down into the valley itself. So the height from that point was really quite dizzying. And that was the point to the, what was said that of Jesus going up to the pinnacle of the temple. It was something that you didn't do if you were afraid of heights. There's two quite strong vertical lines here. I'm sorry, my voice is coming apart again. That's the one I want you to look at first. Herod extended the temple platform. And as we said, we're going to come back now to the point which we made earlier when we were looking at the Wailing Wall. There's some 72 feet of masonry below the current level of the Wailing Wall. And this vertical joint here is the separation between the extension of the temple platform made by the Maccabees and the extension of the temple platform by Herod. The masonry in the base of this is, as you see, large and well laid. That's Herodian masonry. And then when you come right up just about to the edge of the slide, you see that things again change, but they change in a very irregular pattern. And you remember that, well, actually it's not in the Bible, maybe some of you haven't read this point, but in Josephus, and again there are references to it also in the book of Maccabees, when Antiochus Epiphanes took over the city in 186 BC, that he built a tower, and he built it in the southern part of the temple, overlooking the city, it says. So it's felt that that tower was built along what was the south wall at the time when the Seleucids took over Jerusalem. And the line then, this ragged line of poorly, you know, blended masonry, which is just about to the left-hand side of the slide, is where the Maccabean masonry joined in with the pre-existing masonry, some of which probably went back to the time of Nehemiah. So that rough line which you have there delineates what had been the temple platform. And there you see a little closer up of the joint between the Herodian and the Maccabean masonry. Now, it was the line where that Maccabean joint takes off and goes straight across, which is where the middle wall of partition is. And if you, and the east wall has not changed shape, has not changed its position, since it was laid in place there by roughly when Solomon first started to build the walls. It's certainly been there since the time of Hezekiah. So the original temple mount we know was square, and it's felt that the junction between the Maccabean masonry and the masonry which goes back originally to the time of Nehemiah was the boundary of that original temple mount, and that was then 500 cubits square. That delineated where the middle wall of partition stood, and that delineated where the holy part of the temple began, because outside that, outside that middle wall of partition, outside the platform area that had been constructed in the time of Nehemiah, was the court of the Gentiles. That was not holy. This was most of this material that Herod had built. So when Jesus said that there shall not be one stone left upon another of the temple, if he meant that space which the Jews themselves considered holy, a lot of what Herod built was not included. And much of what we see today then is in the area which was not considered holy. And therefore the prophecy is probably quite fulfilled to the letter. So as you go around this east corner, the stairs there, and this is from the reconstruction in the model, go up into those storehouses which the priests used and which they would have reached principally from the triple gate, which we looked at a little further, which was right beside the council house, which was along the south wall. We're going to go along this east wall now. And here you see the corner. We're just going to leave this corner, which is right here, where now the last slide was taken from the period about back there. We're going to go along the east wall. The city of David is extending in this area down the side of the mountain. There's another view of the corner, as it this southeast corner that we just looked at in the previous slide, and another construction of the stairs going up into those priests' storehouses and the windows which would have been there to illuminate those storehouses. And then we go along to the Golden Gate. Now, this gate, in most of the stones that you see, probably goes back to the Umayyad period, which was the early years of the Muslim occupation of this temple site. But the shape of the gate is in, can be seen quite clearly from stones remaining on the inside. Just on the inside, you can see the corners of those stones. And the stones which are just inside those door posts and lintels probably date back to the time of Hezekiah. These are likely the oldest remaining bits of the temple which are inside that masonry at the base is some Herodian masonry, and up above is, of course, masonry, much of which goes back to the time of the Crusaders. But again, because of what the archaeologists have discovered, it's almost certain that that does mark the site of the East Gate. And you're looking now down at the terracing, which comes below, so you get some notion of how steep the ground disappeared into the valley. So what happens then when Jesus used this entrance to the temple on a number of occasions, and he came from the Mount of Olives down the goat trail that was there, came up the other side and then up the little set of stairs, which I'll show you in a second, into the temple. But we know also that there are about 12 layers of Herodian masonry, because Herod rebuilt this whole wall below the present soil level. He went right down to bedrock again. There's a reconstruction of that gate as it probably was at the time of Jesus. This is the East Gate. Went almost directly into the sanctified area of the temple. And then just beyond that was the main entrance to the temple itself. And it has recently been discovered that there were arches below that gate, so the gate which we showed you in that slide entered that way. It's probably wrong. It was probably entered this way, because there were those arches discovered quite recently. So when Jesus went down across the brook Kidron, up the other side in the east gate and into the temple that way, he would have gone up those stairs and turned to go into the temple itself. I'm going to go back so that you can just look in beyond and see that there are steps going up from that point, going up to the level where the actual temple the platform that the temple itself was placed on. So stairs everywhere. Now, quite interestingly, there's a lot known about the height of the rocks. In the 1800s, the archaeologists had much freer access to this temple area than they do today. And there were a number of measurements made of the rock, which can be seen when you go in under the dome of the rock and look down. You can see the rock, which is the top of the mountain there. And then there are transects made, and there are other places where you can discover the actual bedrock level, and outside the Temple Mount there have been drill cores made right down to bedrock. So we have a very accurate notion of the shape of the mountain which is in there. What then happens when you move on past this point, and there's a model of the way the temple and the city were, and you can see the lines, the contours which are there, and this model is of course built up, and I forget the rise in each one of those contour lines, but you can see the way the ground falls off very steeply to the east, and again very steeply in the Tyropoean Valley, which was off to the northwest, and which came down on the other side. So the east and the western side, and the south side of that temple mount, the ground sloped away very quickly. Now, this is quite important, again, when we consider that what Jesus said, there shall not be one stone left upon another. Because when you work out the heights of land, the heights of the original land, you discover that along the eastern wall, the present mount, the present temple platform, which you can go into, is actually lower than this construction which was there in the time of Herod. So it's very apparent that when you get into the temple itself, that the temple, the holy place, was almost certainly taken right down until there was not a stone left, not even its foundations. Now, you're now looking at the Antonia Fortress. It was named after Mark Antony, and it was built by Herod, and of course one of the ways you curry favor with Romans was to name things after senior politicians. We still have this in our society today. Now there was again, Herod had extended the temple platform to the north as he had extended it to the south. So those stairs coming down from the Antonia Fortress were into the court of the Gentiles. It was done, as we well know, so that the Romans knew exactly what was going on in the temple at all times, could keep their eye on these troublemakers which were down there for signs of insurrection, and could literally pour into the temple compound if they felt they had to suppress something. Courtyards around were again for the purpose of commerce. So we've come round the corner. We're almost back at the Wailing Wall. We're now coming back down the Western Wall. Those two little fellows that you can see in there are the archaeologist's children. They're 45 feet apart. The stone that they're measuring for you is 45 feet long by 12 feet high, and it's estimated to be pretty close to 600 tons in weight. So how did you get that in place without the use of modern hydraulics? It's difficult to fathom. The answer, of course, comes, and I mean, apart from a lot of really hard sweat, the answer is that the rock was quarried to the north of the temple area. There was a shallow depression just north of the temple, and then the land went up, and the rock was quarried from that height of land. And then it was run down the slope, gradually, to come into this point. So the masons worked from the inside. They slid their rocks down on fairly level ground, one way or another, and then put them into place, put the fill in behind them to gradually raise the platform, and then extended on beyond that. Now this, as I said, you're in that tunnel, which you can go into today, which is just to the left-hand corner of the Wailing Wall, the chamber, which is the Wailing Wall. And now we're back at the Wailing Wall. We've gone right around the temple. And what we see is that there are several ways in, but that most of the ways when people went into the temple, when the ordinary people went in, were from the south. We're going to look at some of the ways in the next talk, the ways the entrances were used mostly by the priests that come in from the western side. Why from the western side? Because that's where the expensive subdivisions were. And the priests, of course, those who were senior in the hierarchy, they lived in the expensive districts in town. This is from the north. Looking in at the central aspect of this whole temple complex. So far, we've been looking at the platform itself, which was enlarged considerably. Archaeologists feel that at the time of Solomon, the platform surrounding the temple was not that large. But in the time of Nehemiah, it was extended, partly for defensive reasons. And certainly, when you date the work that was going on, by the time of Hezekiah, the temple platform was about 500 cubits square. And it was this square piece, which was inside the middle wall of partition. That was where the holy space began. And nobody who was not authorized was allowed inside that middle wall of partition, as it's called in Paul's writings. So you're looking at the outside of the temple area. And if you notice, there's apartments in there on the upper floors. You notice a sizable building in the one corner. You notice two or three entrances into this area. And they were for specific priestly functions. We're going to look at one of them, just to pick one out. In that little building to the, it's just back top left, and we'll get there in just a second. This is, again, to show you what went on between the middle wall of partition and the other side. Now, the little figures there are indicating what may very well have happened when Jesus overthrew the money changers. The feeling is that what had gone on was that there was so much commerce that it was gradually overflowing from the area which was outside that wooden barricade, which, as I say, Paul labels the middle wall of partition, the place which separated Gentiles from Jews. Commerce was allowed out there. But the sense is that commerce was getting to be so extensive, particularly at the major feast days, when a lot of people had to purchase items for use in the temple, that it had actually strayed over into the platform that Hezekiah had built and Nehemiah had built before him. built after him. And therefore, that was what really incensed Jesus. So, back again to look at the temple from another aspect. Right-hand side of the slide, I'm sorry, I should look at the window behind me to be certain. The right-hand side of the slide is the court of the women. There are four large candlesticks in there. Behind that, then, the courtyard of the priests where the sacrifices were taken. Beyond that, the holy place, which you can see in a large upright front. And then inside that, in the back of that, the Holy of Holies. This is the one of the apartments in the corner of that priestly complex. And we're going to go down into this now because this area and some of the gateways that you can see in there were for the priests that actually tended the altar, that made sure the fires didn't go out, made sure that there was wood there, and that the wood was actually sorted in another place, because if it was wormy, if it was rotten, it would be discarded. And there was a whole sequence of priests that actually looked after that particular function in the temple. But to go down now into the area in the lower part of that apartment complex which you just looked at, below that was a bath. And the priests down there would immerse themselves to cleanse themselves before they came up. They would then dry themselves out beside a fire which was kept in a little archway. They're in the base of their apartments, and then they would be cleaned, ritually cleaned, they would be dried, and they could go into the area where they had to actually look after their priestly duties, to look after the fires and the altar. We're looking now at the complex, temple complex, from the east, from the Mount of Olives, as it were, and you're looking down at the court of the women. And beyond that, the main gateway, which was used when you take your sacrifices to that point, and then just beyond that, where there was a barrier, so that one could actually go into that gateway if you were offering a sacrifice, but not any more than about 10 feet into it, because at that point then the priests took over. The ground was becoming progressively more holy. Looking down, and the place where the altar was. Now, when we read of the story of King David, and what David did when he was about to build the temple, and he was looking at all of these possibilities, David, it is said, bought the threshing floor of Arunah to have that as part of the area where the temple and the tabernacle would be built, would be erected. If you consider when the angel came, it said that the angel was between David and the heavens. So the argument goes that the angel was standing on top of the mountain, that the angel was there in the highest place, and the threshing floor of Arunah would then be below him. So when you come down slightly from the height of land, coming east, there's a sort of slightly wider sill before the ground slopes off again very steeply. So it's quite likely that the threshing floor of Arunah was just below the height of land and just to the east, for several reasons, one of which was that the prevailing winds would make that a good place to have a threshing floor. There'd be little turbulence as the wind came over the hill, which was good for carrying away chaff and so forth. And again, it was the only really flat area. You couldn't do this sort of thing right on top of the mountain. It was a little bit steep right at the very top. So the threshing floor is probably where the altar sits now. Behind us, to the left of the slide, you're going further and further into the holy place. You're looking down at the court of the priests and down at those four spots there where indicate that there were four fires on the altar, two of which were always kept going, one of which was in use. The other was kept alight just as a backup in case they needed it. And then those two would be cleaned off and the other two would be used the following day. And the ashes would go out through another gate in the side out into the outer part of the temple. You're looking at the front of the temple. We'll come back to this point in a little bit when we see once again a slide of Jerusalem as it is today, but just look at the color of the stone. Jerusalem stone actually has a slightly more pink tone to it than that. But in the sun, it must have been magnificent. And then there was the gold that was on the roof and the top of the pillars and so forth that Herod had put there. So when the disciples took Jesus up to the Mount of Olives, they were really impressed and proud of the city that they were part of. You can feel it. And when you see slides like this, you realize just how proud they must have been. The gate into that area, and the slide that you just looked at with that height, is just beyond this. That's decorated in vines. And again, that goes back to the time of Solomon. But it also indicates how the Hebrews did not use animal likenesses or likenesses of people in any of their decorations. That was forbidden under Moses. But they did use plants. They did use flowers to beautify the areas that they were part of. Now, notice also the stairs going up, several sets of stairs, not too great, but several sets of stairs around this Temple Mount, because the land sloped away. So we're looking now again at slide taken from the reconstruction of the temple. We're looking from the southwest corner along the, going away from you towards your right is the area that we talked about at great length, where the shops were and so forth. No, I'm sorry. That's the east wall. To the left is the south wall. Yep. And the shops and so forth were along the south wall. The east wall was mostly a defensive wall in the city. So here's the city. We've concentrated on the temple so far. We've concentrated on the magnificence which was the temple. We've concentrated on this because you can feel in many of the responses which come from the priests to Jesus a real pride and a sense that why would anybody not like what's going on in our society at this time? Because it really was magnificent. But also, you have something which was almost unique in the Roman Empire. You had a city which had been built in 50 or 60 years. Everything was new. Everything shone, except for those little parts of the town that were the remains of the city of David and some of the other densely populated areas that had predated the Maccabees. But large areas of this city were very, very prosperous looking. There were large open spaces, particularly surrounding the temple. Places where you could buy practically anything. That row of stores is no exaggeration. What you find in the archaeological remains are goods from all over the Middle East. Jerusalem had become a very cosmopolitan city. Jerusalem had become an impressive city. Jerusalem had become a place that people traveled to see, the way we go to see things nowadays. Jerusalem had become somewhere that its inhabitants really felt was one of the greatest places on the earth. And we'll come back to many of these points in the next talk in a couple of months when we talk about the city itself and its expansiveness. But just think, I showed you in the beginning a slide of the Dome of the Rock. From the Mount of Olives, you could look down on those courtyards and look down on a setting like that, which is taken from one of the temple models. And you could think of just how grand this whole thing was. And so when Jesus said, "There shall not be one stone left upon another," people must have wondered how that could be, particularly when you look at some of the blocks which weighed about 600 tons. How could it be? And yet, as we have indicated, when you look at the... Okay, we turn the slides back on. Lights back on now, please. When you look at what's there in the archaeological record, it's quite apparent that what Jesus said was true, that prophecy was true. It's also apparent that many of the reactions that people had to what was there are true. The wilderness, which is there in the Gospels. Well, somebody took the clock down. I had figured out when I was supposed to stop, yeah, by looking at the clock. Oh, okay. I had figured out when an hour and a half was. So anyway, okay, so we get down. The temple model is here, if anybody wants to look at it a bit afterwards. That meeting owns that too. So